Hi, I'm Haley Brennan, and you're listening to the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. Today, I'll be talking with Karin Detlefsen about Margaret Cavendish and Anne Conway.
So my name is Karin Detlefsen, and I'm a professor of philosophy and education at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm also a partner with a number of other organizations and individuals on the Shirk-funded New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project. And my two co-investigators on that are Lisa Shapiro at Simon Fraser University, who heads up the project, and Marguerite Delaurier at McGill University.
So my first question for you is just, how did you first become interested in early modern women philosophers?
So when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto working on my dissertation, and my dissertation was on a problem in Descartes, Malebranche, and Leibniz, I was reading some of Leibniz's letters, and including one to Clément. And in that letter, Leibniz mentions that his philosophy is closest to that of Anne Conway, Countess Anne Conway. And when I read that, I was completely taken aback. I was taken aback by two facts. One was that there was a woman writing philosophy in the 17th century, and very quickly after the realization of that fact, I was taken aback by the fact that I'd never before thought about the absence of women figures, at least absence in my education and in my reading of women figures in the history of Western philosophy. And I was amazed that I had never noticed that before or thought about it or wondered about it before. And so it was that the mention of Conway's name in Leibniz's work that then got me to chase up this character and Conway and take a look at what she was writing. And very quickly from there, I discovered this whole world of women philosophers, a world that had been slowly brought to the academic attention by people like Sarah Hutton and Eileen O'Neill, Mary Ellen Waithe, and a number of other really excellent and visionary philosophers.
So did you start your study and work on early modern women by looking at Conway, or was there someone else who caught your attention in this investigation?
So I was nearing the end of my dissertation at this time, but I noticed it was with Conway that the first paper I wrote on women was on Conway. But it was actually a paper not just on Conway, but on Conway, Leibniz, and Van Helmont. And I was... So my dissertation was on generation and individuation. So how to think about the generation, the reproduction and formation of new life, and in particular against the background of a mechanical philosophy. So what we now think of as embryology was a super hard test case for the mechanical philosophy in the 17th century. So a lot of people were trying to sort of sort out how to deal with this in the history of natural philosophy. And there was this really crazy theory, what to us seems like a crazy theory, but it makes a lot of sense if you think about the historical context, that all new living things were created at one and the same time at the creation by God, and that the apparent generation of new living things is just the becoming visible of what was previously invisible. And I realized that this theory was put forward not just as a way of dealing with the difficulty of embryology against a background of mechanism, but it was also put forward as a way of trying to think about individuation and the nature of the individual. So that was what I was working on my dissertation. And I noticed that Conway had some really interesting material in her text, The Most Ancient and Modern Philosophy, but she has some really interesting material on generation, on the puzzle of how new life comes into being. And so I was interested in looking at, you know, interrogating Leibniz's claim that his philosophy and Anne Conway's philosophy are close through the lens of the problem of generation. And so I wrote a paper looking at those two figures, as well as Van Helmont, who is also in that circle of thinkers, later called vitalist thinkers at the time. And so my first paper was on Conway, but trying to show that Leibniz was wrong, that he and Conway have very significant and fundamental differences.
So can you tell me a little bit more about Conway's philosophy, especially such that Leibniz was so wrong in claiming that they had this close connection?
Well, so I think that there are lots and lots of ways in which one can show that. One thing that Leibniz might have been thinking about was this thought that they both talk about monads. Now, that was not original with either of them. I think it goes back in the early modern period to Bruno, who also spoke about monads. But what Leibniz means by monad and what Conway means by a monad are just very, very different. They're just simply incompatible, depending, of course, on how you read those characters. But I do think that one really viable way of reading them is, for Leibniz, a monad is a immaterial, unextended point of activity. But that's not what a monad is for Conway. A monad has extension. So this was one point of difference, but I got to that point of difference plus a number of other different points by showing that, listen, Leibniz endorses this theory that God creates all living things at the creation. It's a theory called preexistence, or sometimes called preformation. He endorses that as the theory by which we account for the generation of new life, whereas Conway endorses the rival theory in the 17th century, the theory of epigenesis, which is that life forms anew throughout the history of the world through sequential formation of organic parts, and it's sort of a self-generation. This coming into being is something that the individual itself has a role in. And so I started with that difference, and I said, well, what can this difference tell us about their different philosophies? And I think it's that difference as a lens through which we can see all kinds of differences, what they mean by monads, what they mean by life, what they mean, how they think about the nature of the material world, material substance. The relationship between God and world is very different for them. I mean, it's sort of endless almost how different their two philosophies are when you get down to the details.
What questions are you currently pursuing in the 17th and 18th century?
So I've just finished working on a number of papers on Margaret Cavendish and also on Anne Conway. But let's just so other than this paper on Conway, which was not published, it was just a paper I workshopped around as a graduate student, earliest work was all focused on Margaret Cavendish. And in my earlier work, I was particularly interested in questions of metaphysics and natural philosophy, and just getting a sense of how her account of the substances of the world was meant to work as an account. So issues to do with substance and causation and free will, really metaphysical and so natural philosophical questions. And then after that, for a while, I was interested in her value theory and thinking about freedom, not so much from the perspective of the metaphysics of free will, but from the perspective of the ethics of freedom and political freedom. And in particular, how she thought women fit into issues to do with freedom in relationships and freedom in politics. And then more recently, I've been trying to bring these two threads together. So one paper that I've worked on that I think it might be in press, I'm not sure, is looking at the nature of the human mind, the nature and the individuation of the human mind in Anne Conway and Margaret Cavendish, because they have monistic philosophies. And by that, what I mean is that everything in the world is made up of the same stuff. And for Conway, everything in the world has wisdom. And for Cavendish, everything in the world has rationality. And so then it becomes an interesting question: what, if anything, makes a human being special? or less suggestive way, what, if anything, makes a human being different from everything else? And so so I was looking through those two, their work, to figure out what makes a human a human. But in the process of that, and specifically looking at Cavendish, it became clear that she does have this radical leveling of hierarchy. There is, in some sense, no hierarchy among creatures for her. So it's not like humans are above other animals or above non-living things, but rather there's some very significant leveling process that goes on. But then that becomes very interesting against a reading of her politics, in which she has been interpreted as a royalist. And so part of that paper was just to make some suggestions about, there are these two really interesting features of her work that seem to be in tension, and how might we think about ways forward in that. And so a paper I'm just finishing up now is trying to think about the relationship between her political philosophy and her philosophy of the nature of individuals, for example, and whether or not she really is a royalist. There's been some claim out there that she's actually a Republican when it comes to politics. So I'm looking at that in her work in this paper that I'm finishing up now. And then another paper I've been working on in her is how to think about the nature of laws of nature and order in the natural world, since I think she has a really interesting account of orderliness in the world that presages some ideas that we find in 20th and 21st century feminist accounts in philosophy of science. And had we not lost her in human historical thought, we wouldn't be redoing all that work now. So that's what I'm thinking about on Cavendish. But as I say, I'm wrapping all that work up now and getting back in the spring and for the foreseeable future to work on Emily du Châtelet. So Andrew Janiak and I are thinking through some issues in her natural philosophy. And I'm also very interested in her account of women and women's happiness and women's public and private roles and freedom, both metaphysically, but also women's freedom specifically.
Cool. That's really, really interesting. So for either Cavendish or du Châtelet, or both, you talked about their natural philosophy and their metaphysics. And you mentioned that it's potentially that Cavendish's metaphysics is in tension with her royalist views, or could be seen as being in tension with her royalist views. But how do their metaphysics relate to their views on women? Can you say a little bit more about these, the connections between the metaphysics and their ethics or their value theory?
Yeah, less on du Châtelet, because I'm not clear about the degree of systematicity in her work. Ruth Hagengruber at Paderborn has done some really interesting work on this front, on how du Châtelet's physics and issues to do with freedom and determinism interact in really interesting ways. So her work would be good work to turn to think through that. But on Cavendish, so she's a materialist, maybe. But let's say for now she's a materialist, and this puts her in a precarious, in some sense, position in the 17th century with respect to women. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So people like Astle were thrilled at the Cartesian idea of the human being as essentially an immaterial thinking thing, because an immaterial thinking thing, when abstracted away from the material bodies in which they are found, or in which the material body in which it is found, is not sexed. And there's the promise of radical egalitarianism for women in that Cartesian notion. Now, Descartes and Astel both realize that souls are embodied, and embodiment makes a huge difference in how the thinking thing interacts with the world around them. But insofar as fundamental metaphysics goes, immaterial thinking things, and for Astel, immaterial thinking things that have a very particular and special and primary relationship with God, allows her to claim radical natural equality among men and women. And this is a central plank of her thinking about men and women in their fundamental nature, is that we're all there may be individual differences, but they are not differences that are grounded in sex. They're just individual differences. So she's a non-essentialist when it comes to thinking about men and women, at least at the fundamental level. Now, women were often associated in this time with their bodies and with their passions and with their incapacity to reason and whatnot, in contrast with the way that Descartes saw human beings, and the way in which Astel explicitly put his conception of the nature of human beings to proto-feminist or feminist use. So an explicit contrast to that was the idea that women are primarily defined by their material natures, by their bodies, by their proneness to the passions and passions overblown and consequently an incapacity to be rational creatures and whatnot. And so on a materialist ontology, which is what Cavendish has, there's the threat of that re-entering, the threat of gender essentialism grounded in biological differences or material differences that's just waiting to emerge in her work. And you can read that, depending upon, you can find texts that support that view in Cavendish, that differences in material construction of men and women's bodies makes a difference in their natures in some sense. But oftentimes those texts are, when put in context, could be seen as almost scornful rehashing of this way of thinking about women. But when you turn to her plays, when you turn to her fiction, you get a different kind of account, which is an account of women as socially constructed to be less intellectual, simply because they haven't had a chance to push themselves intellectually, because avenues of education are closed to them. And so it's always hard to read, to sort of discern a single right way of reading Cavendish, as it is for, I think, every historical figure, but most particularly for her, given the huge range of ways in which she wrote and some of which are ways of thinking about philosophy that we now recognize. Some of her texts are recognizably philosophical to us, but others are more like fiction, but filled with philosophical work, but not arguments for a position, rather presentations of different positions by different characters. So it is hard to sort of tease out what Cavendish's own view might be. But there's this very, very strong thread in her work that humans are different from other animals, but within the human community there are not really significant differences grounded in material natures or in biology, but rather differences are social and socially constructed, as we would now say.
You mentioned that this kind of social constructivist view, if we call it, is found mostly in her plays and her fiction writing, which I think prompts a question about how we distinguish other forms of writing from philosophical works, or whether we should distinguish at all, especially in this project of reinvigorating new narratives or finding new narratives. Should we be expanding both our conception of who is a philosopher, as well as what philosophy is, philosophical writing looks like?
So this is something that I've been troubling over for the last few years, as are these meta questions about the nature of philosophy and the nature of the philosopher. And they really have come to the fore with me as a result of reading these women and reading their works, and the way in which these women gain an audience in a world in which women are not meant to be philosophers, or perhaps in a world in which their work is going to be met with scrutiny and criticism simply because they're women. And because they're writing about things that are potentially problematic and subversive, given given the nature of the time, and also given that some figures we think of as philosophers, because they write in ways that we now think of, we in the analytic Anglo-analytic tradition now think of as being philosophy, we see that they write in that way sometimes, but then we notice that they're also writing in a lot of different ways, and it sort of invites us to think about what's going on in those other writings. So as I say, I've been troubling over this over the course of the last few years, and trying to think about what a philosopher is and what a piece of philosophy is. And in order to sort of clarify my thinking on this, I've sort of divided up the terrain into a number of different kinds of questions. And one of them connects in with this article that Lisa wrote, which is what is distinctively philosophical content? So what makes a question or an issue philosophical as opposed to something else? And I think there are various ways that one can answer that any philosopher could agree with. But then there are other issues on the table, which is, okay, so if somebody's writing a piece of philosophy, what's the purpose they have in writing that philosophy? And what audience is it that they're trying to reach? And given their purpose and their audience, what genre best allows them to achieve that purpose and reach that audience? And what are the methods that are at work within that genre? And so then you might get something like Maria or the Wrongs of Women, written by Mary Wollstonecraft. And one way of reading that text, one of many different ways of reading that text, is to read it as having a purpose of showing what happens to a human individual, in this case Maria, when she is not, when her social circumstances deprive her of an opportunity to cultivate the thing that is most human about her, and that is her capacity to think rationally. And we get a very visceral and hair-raising image of this woman right from the start of this book, of a woman in extreme rage and grief and despair at having been wrongfully separated from her child and put in a home for an insane person. And there's emotional power in those opening scenes that simply cannot be carried by an analytic piece of philosophy. And it serves a purpose, which is to show what happens to a human when her nature is thwarted by social circumstances. And it reaches a certain audience. And the best genre for this is fiction. And what are the methods? Not presenting arguments for a conclusion, but showing something that is crucially important to know about human life. And so of those five dimensions, so to speak, philosophical content, purpose, audience, genre, and method, the thing that locks a piece of work into the category of philosophy is the content. Are there philosophical questions or issues being raised in this work? But then suddenly that breaks open so much of what we read in not in philosophy classes as being potential texts for philosophy. I don't have a problem with that kind of openness, but there will always, I think there are arguments that could be made, and including good arguments, that philosophy has to be, I think they're good arguments. I don't think they're decisive in the end, that there has to be something more definitive of what makes something philosophy than just that it deals with philosophical content. And then really interesting issues about gatekeeping emerge from that. What is it that defines what counts as, and who counts as a philosopher?
Thank you so much, Karen. This was Really, really interesting.
Thanks so much, Haley, for giving me the opportunity to talk about something that I love to talk about.
Thank you for listening to the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. The New Narratives Project and podcast are funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. In the spirit of the project, the music for the podcast is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonice. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net, and follow us on Facebook. We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.